Welcome to Fortress on a Hill. I'm Henry.
I'm Danny.
I'm Kagan.
We're three leftist veterans that aim to expose the reality of the U.S. military's multiple wars abroad and to illuminate the damage military service does to Americans.
American presidents throughout U.S. history have used American military and diplomatic power to force regime change of democratically elected governments around the world.
Most veterans come from families vested in prior service, and American generals choose their own, ensuring diversity of thought never interferes with American warmongering.
How can we stand by and do nothing while our military kills and destroys lives the world over, while telling Americans that all this death and destruction protects them from terrorists when nothing could be more false?
Fortress on a Hill aims to change that.
Well, all right, everybody. Listeners, we have another great pod today, and another awesome guest. We've really been on fire, as you may have noticed, just been scheduling awesome people, and we're so thankful that they've been coming on. Today we have Mr. Gareth Porter, who many of you may know, may have followed, or read his stuff. If you haven't, hopefully this pod kind of, you know, opens that up to you. And you know, Gareth, I just want to say that I think it's standard practice in any like interviewing community to tell all your guests that that you're a fan, but but I actually am a longtime fan, and that's true. And we met for the first time at the Tabard Inn, if right. You remember, which I don't even remember what year that was. I mean, time stopped.
Yeah, a couple years ago, I guess.
Right. It was an event with our mutual friend Fritzy at the Tabard Inn in D.C. Of all things, I was there giving a two-day sort of talk on the American Revolution, you know, and its 18th century relevance to today. And you showed up, and it was pretty cool and exciting. And you know, ever since then, obviously, I've still been doing the history as analogy thing, although cautiously, but I have been a longtime follower. You know, I think that you're one of those figures, and there are so many in the media space today who should be daily, you should be a daily face, you know, on CNN or MSNBC. And that's difficult to do. And it's not common. And yet, you know, we don't often get those voices like yours in that sort of mainstream press. I mean, obviously you've broken through on splits, and just to give the very briefest of bios for the listeners who don't know, Gareth Porter is an independent investigative journalist. He's covered national security policy for decades, really, and was the recipient of the 2012 Gellhorn Prize for Journalism, specifically for his coverage of the U.S. war in Afghanistan. He is a graduate of the University of Illinois, Chicago, and Cornell. Is that right?
That's right. Yeah. Got at Cornell. Yeah.
Right. PhD at Cornell in Southeast Asian Studies, which is interesting and relevant. Much of his early work as a scholar and, dare I say, activist surrounded the American war in Vietnam and the region. He was, in fact, a chairman of the Committee of Concerned Asian Scholars at Cornell, then a Saigon bureau chief within the country in 1977-1, I believe. Especially since 2005, though, he's regularly reported on political, diplomatic, and military developments in the Middle East for a variety of mainstream and alternative publications. He's written several books. Some previous highlights include The Perils of Dominance, Imbalance of Power, and the Road to War in Vietnam, and Manufactured Crisis, The Untold Story of the Iran Nuclear Scare. Among many others. His most recent is the CIA Insider's Guide to the Iran Crisis, co-authored with John Kirkow. Currently, he has a column that you absolutely must follow at The Gray Zone, which I think is one of the best alternative outlets available for readers today. I've been a Max Blumenthal fan for a long time, and I've really been enjoying your columns there. So, Gareth, just once again, we're super excited to have you, and thanks for taking the time in these crazy moments.
Well, thanks so much, Danny. I'm really happy to be on your show and glad to have the connection with Kagan as well. And, you know, look forward to a great discussion with you guys. I know this is a good place to get into a much more well-grounded and complex discussion of the problem of the American national security state, the military-industrial congressional complex, whatever you wish to call it, and we share that deep interest in this problem, and I think this could be a great opportunity to compare notes and learn from one another.
Absolutely, you know, we here on Forest on a Hill, you know, the three of us are veterans. You know, Kagan was Navy intelligence with some work with the NSA. Henry was military police, did Iraq. And of course, I did Iraq and Afghanistan with CAV units. And the point is that, we were sort of water carriers for the empire, right? Tools of the national security state that we're going to talk about for quite some time. And so we do have a lot of listeners who are veterans, although not exclusively. But the system, right, the systemic part, not acting like history began yesterday, is really important to us, I think, because we were part of that. So before digging into, any specifics in your recent columns and books, which I'm sure you talk about a lot, and some of the subjects you're perhaps best known for covering, we'd like to talk, especially but not exclusively in the midst of this COVID pandemic, about the broader subject that you mentioned of American national security strategy or lack thereof. In our scheduling messages, you mentioned that you're working on a forthcoming project or a book eventually that you're thinking of titling National Security as a Racket. Obviously, that's a play on my longtime, soulmate Smedley Butler's short book from the 1930s, War is a Racket, right? About his 30 or so years in the Banana Wars, et cetera. Right. You also said in our conversation, I think rather correctly, that the old definition of national security as practiced since World War II is now dead in the water and demands kind of a completely new concept to replace it. So perhaps as a broad opening to our discussion today, you can start with, three things, but I can review them after each part. But essentially, if you can review the old national security consensus, such as it was, and then explain why you think it's obsolete and what evidence you're seeing. And then finally, maybe give us a brief initial crack at what a more appropriate conceptual replacement might be. And I know that's a lot, but we'll sort of, I'll prod you along.
That's a very big order. But before I try to get into that, I do want to add something that I didn't get to in my opening remarks, which is that I have been a great admirer of your writing from the time that I first encountered it. You are a very distinctive figure in the movement to criticize and to bring about change in the whole U.S. military sphere, military intelligence sphere. And I just can't tell you how much I admire your determination. I mean, the degree to which you work so hard at churning stuff out, I couldn't possibly match your output and the intensity of your work, I don't think. And that causes me to really set a step back and admire you in the most admiring terms is all I can say. So I just want to say to tell you that keep it up. This is what we need. You are definitely part of what has to be happening in this country. And to build on that is really the name of the game.
I appreciate that. I mean, I'm just so happy to be part of the conversation and in the same movement as folks like you. And it's really nice to hear that. So thank you.
You're welcome, indeed. And so just to come to the question of the definition of national security, the way in which it's been defined, I presume that you mean essentially since the beginning of the Cold War, since the present system actually began to unfurl, began to form, right? I mean, it's how the national security state has defined its mission. I think that there are two sides to this coin. One side is the public side you know, the propaganda themes that are used by the national security state, which are that, you know, emphasizing that this is a dangerous world, that the United States is always facing threats to our security, to the security of the American people, as well as to the international order that the United States founded at the outset after World War II, and which has kept the peace. I'm now using, you know, in quotes, the kinds of language that have been put forward by the national security state over the years, that this U.S.-sponsored peace has been the one that has kept order throughout the world, and is under threat now from our major adversaries, particularly China and Russia, but also, you know, the smaller adversaries of Iran and North Korea. So, I mean, I think that kind of summarizes the formal presentation, if you will, of the concept of national security. But behind that, I think, is a very different reality in terms of how the national security state has defined the interests of the U.S. government and, by once removed, then the interests of the American people. In other words, the assumption is that the American people have the same interests that they do, which, of course, is not true. But the way I think they understand this is that they must continue to maintain the system of bureaucratic power and control over resources that they have been developing over several decades now, in order to be able to carry out the policies and programs that that they regard as necessary to defend those interests that that they've presented publicly to the American people. And so that gets us into, I think, closer to the heart of what the interests of the national security state really are. And I think the essence of my approach, which I hope to translate into a new book that will really present a very different understanding of the U.S. national security bureaucracy, national security state, is that this congeries of national security bureaucracies, the armed services, the Pentagon's civilian offices, you know, of course, the Secretary of Defense on top of it, and the intelligence community led by the CIA, but including National Security Agency, also the newest entrants, the Department of Homeland Security, all these bureaucracies have their own interests at heart, at the center of their functioning. And their primary duty, in effect, although not formally, not publicly, is to ensure that they continue to maintain or to increase their resource base, which they get through congressional appropriations, by making sure that there aren't any serious cuts in their appropriations, and if possible, to increase that, to increase their resource base. And this basically is the primary motor, if you will, of the operations of the national security state, because that really is the motivation for them to make sure that they push for policies, programs that will have the result that they will get, will continue to be regarded as necessary, that they'll have more legitimacy, and that they'll have more power over these public resources. And so throughout the Cold War and since the Cold War, they have been putting forward strong recommendations, putting pressure on presidents to adopt policies that have resulted in a series of major wars, and of course a lot of minor wars, and some continuing that are not intended to end anytime soon. And I would argue, and I will argue in my book, that this is all the result of this dynamic that I've described of coalition of bureaucracies really being determined to maintain their control over resources and doing whatever is necessary to ensure that that continues. And in the process, what that causes them to do is to get the United States into conflicts that continue the need or maintain the alleged need for more resources going to the military and the intelligence community, and more recently the Department of Homeland Security, of course, and thus it's a self-perpetuating dynamic, and I think that's the essence of the idea that I want to get across. And I'll stop there, and we can discuss that a bit.
Absolutely, I think that the idea of this is a self-perpetuating machine, or as soldiers in the bureaucracy of the military always called, a self-licking ice cream cone, right, Kagan and exactly. Henry. But that, I mean, that people say that, and yet I think what you're doing is complicating it and contextualizing it. You know, it's more than a platitude, it's a way of life, it seems. And so, you know, before we get to, you know, initial thoughts and predictions and prescriptions are way more difficult than identifying problems in some cases, although people often do it without thinking about the problem in the first place. But before we kind of get into that, you know, what are you seeing recently, both before and after, you know, the moment of pandemic,
right,
that is showing fractures or obsolescence in this system, and potential that it might be ready to morph or change or be meaningfully challenged?
Yeah, this is absolutely the crucial issue of the moment. I agree with you on that, Danny. We really need to dig into it as deeply as possible. And you know, my observation, first of all, is that the coronavirus pandemic is clearly the biggest potential moment of crisis for the national security state that they've seen thus far. It hasn't happened yet. It has not matured into a full-fledged crisis. But as you suggested in your question, there are signs that they're danger signs for them. Let's put it that way. And the first one is really what happened with regard to the Theodore Roosevelt affair, when a major U.S. Ship in the Pacific, or you know, headed to the Pacific, it hadn't gone out yet, was stricken by the coronavirus, and they went ahead with their plans to go ahead and launch to begin their mission. Instead of you know, pulling back and saying, okay, you know, we're going to put taking care of the pandemic and its impact on the sailors first, the Pentagon, the Navy specifically, tried to maintain the schedule and essentially was resistant to pulling back. And as a result, you know, I think all your listeners are very well aware of the storyline that the captain of the ship had his plea for really taking at least 1,000 sailors off, or most of the sailors off the boat as soon as possible, and getting them to a safe place where they could be treated and avoid a calamity of major proportions. And that, of course, blew up in the face of the Navy, and we've now seen the result of that. And I think one of the results that is very important to understand is that the families of the sailors were not happy with the way the Navy dealt with this crisis on board the Theodore Roosevelt. And it happened again with regard to the to another ship, the name of which now is escaping me. Do you remember there's another ship which was having coronavirus cases.
And, right. I think it was like a destroyer or a cruiser rather than an aircraft carrier, but I can't remember the name, but there was a follow-on case. Absolutely.
I've forgotten it in a moment. But in any case, again, the families of sailors were upset with the way it was being handled because they were not testing the crew. They were testing only those who had shown basically coronavirus symptoms. And it was not being handled in a way that was suggesting that they really cared about the health of the sailors first. And so, I mean, this is one of those fracture points, as I think you mentioned, that has the potential, certainly, over time to mature into a bigger movement to demand that the obvious primacy of the coronavirus pandemic be given appropriate weight by the Pentagon and the services. And I think there have been changes, of course, since the Theodore Roosevelt crisis occurred. And I think they've been forced to somewhat pull back from the sort of all-out commitment to meeting their schedule for deployment and so forth. But nevertheless, I think that the Pentagon and the Armed Services priorities have been very clear, that they did not give primary service to the health of their own soldiers and sailors. And I think that this is one of the things that should be taken into account by the public in terms of their understanding that things need to be changed fundamentally. And this happens against the background of the point that is obvious to, I think, just about everybody in the United States. I mean, there are exceptions, of course, but I think the overwhelming majority of Americans now understand that the only real threat to the security of Americans does not come from the Chinese or the Russians or the Iranians or the North Koreans, or for that matter, from even Al-Qaeda. They all pale into insignificance in comparison with this pandemic. And you know, this is a pandemic which people who were familiar with the problem have been warning about for years and years. And you know, lest people forget, in 2015 and 2016, beginning in 2009, actually, the United States has experienced a whole series of pandemics. And so they have not, it's not the first time that this has happened. And they've been told that there's going to be a much worse one on the way for years and years. And they were supposed to have had a very detailed plan at hand in order to deal with it. And of course, it didn't happen because of a neoliberal sort of approach to this whole problem that had taken over not just under Trump, but under Obama. That basically the idea was that, well, we'll wait until we see the pandemic arise, and then we'll go out and get the necessary tools for the doctors, the nurses, the ventilators, and the N95 masks, and so forth. And of course, that was stupid. I mean, because that's not the way it works. You have to be prepared ahead of time, and that's precisely the notion that obviously informs the Pentagon and the rest of the national security state. They prepare for wars that might happen 20, 25 years in the future, right? And which are very unlikely at that. Whereas in the case of a pandemic, they really didn't do anything to prepare for what they should have known was a very strong likelihood at some point in the near future. And so I think the lesson of this is one that should penetrate the political system and the society. So far, it really hasn't happened yet. And I'm waiting for that to be the real test of whether we're going to get fundamental change, not only in the political system in general, about this whole issue of what national security is about, but change in the structure and functioning of the military and the Pentagon and the intelligence community. And so far, I have to say, My hopes that fundamental change would begin to be felt have not been met. And this brings us to another aspect of the problem, which is just how few resources we seem to have in this society for bringing about change. And I'm sure that's something that you are very familiar with, and you know, you'd be interested in having something to say about as well.
Absolutely. I mean, I think the persistence in the face of pandemic of militarism escalation in certain places like Somalia and potentially Iran, Iraq, at least in terms of plans, has been really disturbing. So like you, I think I would describe myself as hopeful, if not optimistic, about the chance here or the potential. You know, what was striking about the Crozier incident, the captain of the aircraft carrier with COVID, as well as so the response to that and then the response to this in general has been both a public one and a philosophical one. And I'd be interested to know what you think about this. So it has struck me in two ways. First, that the public, whether it be the sailors themselves, their families, or just readers of mainstream newspapers, you know, it seemed that, you know, 2-1 or more, they were favorable towards the captain and really disturbed by the Navy response or even the whole Pentagon response. And even though that may seem like a small thing or a one-off incident, I think that it has potential in the sense that, you know, if we can show, we being the broader movement and just folks who care in general, that look, not just the pandemic, but the forever wars in general are not in the interest of your sons and daughters and the distant American soldiers that you know purport to adore, you know, that could have an effect. And then the philosophical one was more, you know, maybe less common, you know, people who are just focused on their jobs and living paycheck to paycheck and don't think about these things as much as you and I do. But for a lot of us, what seems more apparent than ever is that no amount of aircraft carriers or missiles or tanks in our current Pentagon structure is really going to be able to have any meaningful effect against the only two real existential national security threats, being either a pandemic or a new worse one, or the just climate crisis in general. I mean, the only use, it seems, of the aircraft carrier at the moment of climate catastrophe is that they may be some of the last folks alive in their floating city. But I think so from the public and the philosophical perspective, I think there's been an exposure for Corona. And then I guess what I would be interested in is just in a general sense, what you make of my assertions, and then also, you know, what steps could be taken in order to reframe this to something more logical in terms of a national security posture.
Yeah, I mean, I think you know, you made a couple of at least a couple of points which were coming down in a way on both sides of the issue. Some of it more you know, logically suggesting that this could and should be the beginning of a broader movement, and secondly, that you know, that there has been thus far still no major outcropping of protest that shows us that there's something that is underway already to bring about change. And I think that we are in a situation where this is an enormous set of contradictions between, on one side, the obvious nature of the crisis that the society and therefore the all the institutions that are part of the society are going through and inevitably must cause a kind of a crisis which we still cannot define the nature of. But on the other side, you have a society that has been so subject to a concatenation of power structures that have gained traction, have gained control over all the major levers of power in the society for a number of decades now. You have, of course, the you know, the major elites, the financial elite, the healthcare elite and the military-industrial elite all having gained control over the levers of power, meaning that both the executive branch and the legislative branch have been essentially colonized by these interests because they dispose of so much money that they essentially buy off certainly buy off the Congress. That's obvious. But in a sense, they also own the executive branch as well. So that degree of power has been building steadily over the last 4, 5, 6 decades, and has accelerated really in the last two or three decades. The second point I would make is that what everybody listening to your podcast already knows, that the corporate media are fully part of that power structure. They are owned by people who are directly connected with the financial elite. They are tied in fully with the other corporate elites, the healthcare elite and the military industrial complex elite, to the point where, they are ready to carry their water consciously and unconsciously, so that any message that goes against the interest that we're talking about here is not going to get through. And then the third point is that I think, and in a way, this is perhaps most devastating, that you've had an atomization of the society in social and political terms. That you had during the Vietnam War, and even at the outset of the Iraq War, a major anti-war movement that had millions of people in the streets ready to protest. And they represented a kind of moral majority in the country in a way. Now that's gone. That's dissipated. That's been swallowed up by the social and economic trends of the past few decades. The younger people who were part of the anti-war movement have moved on to the suburbia. They've gotten jobs. They've gotten involved in other issues. They become part of the Democratic Party. They supported Barack Obama when he was going to war all over the world, and they've lost their fervor against war. And at the same time, you've had the sort of strong opposition to the wars be broken up into tiny fragments of ideological points of view that involve lots of people who are subscribing to all kinds of weird theories about various people and institutions and what they can accomplish secretly, and the theories that have been somehow used against a lot of people who are against the war, right? I mean, the left has been broken up and fragmented. The right is on the rise, and this is all setting the stage, it seems to me, for a period during which there is simply no way to move forward politically without some new factor that we have not been able to identify arising, whether that's people desperate for food, rioting, breaking into stores, creating a major civil crisis. That's the only thing that comes to mind that I can think of, and I'm just talking off the top of my head here, but those are my thoughts about what the problem that we face here and just how serious it is.
Absolutely. And the fracturing of the left and the squelching purposely, really, by Nixon, by getting rid of the draft, of the anti-war movement, although it was more complex than just that, has been disturbing. And so as I pivot over to Henry and force myself to shut up for a while, I think that though I don't subscribe to the conspiratorial thinking per se that this was planned in any way. It is convenient, of course, for any power structure that in the midst of pandemics and the social control that follows, it's increasingly difficult, if not impossible, to organize if the will were even there. And clearly, as you pointed out, most disturbing, as you called it, the will has not been, or at least the mass will, which really bothers me. So, I think we're going to build on a couple more thoughts on the pandemic's relationship to this, and then, you know, feel free to jump in on anything, of course, that interests you as well, Gareth.
Sure.
So I wanted to talk a little bit about one of the responses to the pandemic from President Trump and the Trump administration. In June this year, the president is scheduled to give the commencement speech at West Point, despite other military academies doing a remote graduation or maintaining strict social distancing. And while we don't know if families or other guests will be permitted, what we do know for sure is that at least 1,000 cadets will return from isolation and potentially expose themselves to the pandemic, along with the staff at West Point and the families, the communities in the surrounding area. Gareth, would you share with us a bit on the pandemic of 1918 and how the military was central to its spread? And do you think an event like this, like this commencement, could create a huge new spike in infections, similar to what happened in Philadelphia with the Liberty Bond Parade in 1918?
Well, that's a very interesting question indeed. And you know, to the degree that the White House is serious about this, it is totally bizarre and just beyond belief. You know, it's hard to even imagine that somebody is so stupid as to do that, but we'll just hold off on that aspect of it. To go back to 1918, you know, this was a pandemic that did indeed, as you suggested, underline the, even then, before the Cold War, decades before the Cold War, the degree to which the military had become an interest group which was set apart from the interests of society and really privileged its own interests over those of the society. Now, you know, to some extent, you could argue there were extenuating circumstances that they didn't fully understand or didn't understand sufficiently. The degree to which this pandemic could take could have such devastating effects so quickly, but I don't really buy that because of a quote that I used in my story, which I'm sure you remember. The chief of staff of the army, who was dealing with the general in Europe in sort of supplying the bodies that were supposed to be sent by the tens of thousands across the sea to be chewed up and lost in the war. The chief of staff was saying that I think what he was saying was that we're
you want me to read the question again?
Yeah. Let's go back to where
we're. Sure, no problem. So, could you share with us a bit on the pandemic, and that could an event like the commencement create a huge new spike in infection similar to what happened in Philadelphia?
Yeah. So, the chief of staff was basically saying that he was going to deliver as many troops as were necessary, as were demanded by the command in Europe. But he was saying, you know, we do have a problem here at home. We have I believe it was 20,000 people stricken by this, and it's getting worse. So they understood perfectly well what the cost of continuing the war without regard to its effect on the home front was. They knew that they were playing with fire. And that's a very key point to underline here about the military bureaucracy, because even then, during World War I, you had a situation where the military was privileging its own bureaucratic interests to fight that war, and to do so in a way that satisfied its own version of what it was after. And even though, you know, there were more American soldiers actually killed by the virus than were killed by the war in World War I. I mean, you know, this is an amazing fact that people are not generally aware of. And it just shows that the U.S. military then was ready to serve its own interests, despite the fact that it was harming, it was doing harm to the soldiers in a way that was just far beyond any reasonable sacrifice. And so there was a real problem here that the military was seizing a degree of power that it shouldn't have had, and which in a way it forecasts what we've seen during and since the Cold War started.
I was also thinking about the fact that so many leaders on our end of the war didn't want to share too much information about how the pandemic was affecting the military because of the nature of the war. I want to say a comment in your piece about the German high command would not be, you know, they wouldn't be sitting down at the table to negotiate a surrender if they knew how much the flu was going around.
Oh, right. That's true. That's a good point. Yes, it was a matter of, they knew how bad it was. We're hoping to keep it from the Germans. That's right. Yeah. So they had to play a very nasty game with the American people just for the purpose of, as you say, essentially deceiving the Germans. Yeah.
So following up on that a bit, how do you see this boding for the future of the military? U.S. forces in general, but especially the Navy, have shown their vulnerability to an outbreak of this kind. But because military units and operations are so compartmentalized, will American forces truly embrace any existential change here?
Yeah, it's hard to know exactly how this is going to play out. I mean, the U.S. military bureaucracy is certainly, they started out with the intention of trying to go ahead without regard to the immediate human cost of the coronavirus. But I think they've had to make some changes, obviously, in their schedule in order to deal with what had become a pretty serious crisis and to head off much more serious problems with their own family, with the families of their own sailors. And that may have caused them to at least make some change in their expectations about how fast they can move. But even now, I believe that they are still trying to meet a schedule for deployments, which is really quite unrealistic. And so there is still, I think, a lot of tension here between the bureaucratic interests of this military-industrial complex and the interests of the health of the soldiers and sailors. And I think that we still have to see how that's going to play out. But I do hope that there will be more protest against what has happened already and what may continue to happen in the near future. I think that's one of the salients here that offers some promise of raising issues which must be discussed as a matter of high intensity, extreme need at this moment for American society because of the power that the military bureaucracies have in the society, and the fact that they have had their way so completely, it's an uphill battle. But I think we have to hope that there will be some disturbance of the peace, if you will, that will raise issues that will force a major debate. Now, I should add here that there was an article published a few weeks ago in which a former high army general who was the commander of U.S. A retired army general who was head of U.S. forces or international forces in Afghanistan, and a co-author were arguing that this coronavirus is in fact going to force major changes in the way in which the Pentagon does business, and they were suggesting that they were going to have to be some cuts in the military budget, some serious cuts in the military budget as a result of this, because of the major spending that has already been done. It still remains to be seen whether that's going to be the case, but they were raising the possibility that there was going to be a serious conflict between the emergency spending that has had to be put forward already with regard to the coronavirus, and the desire of the Pentagon to keep full funding, more or less full funding, for its next year's financial, for its next year's fiscal year budget. So we have to see how that's going to play out. But I think some people are actually expecting that there's going to be a real crunch here, that the president administration is going to be forced to consider serious cuts in the military budget for the next fiscal year.
The guys and I love doing the podcast. Being able to share our experiences in the military with allies and supporters means the world to us. But we can't do all the work. We need you to share an episode of ours with someone, anyone whom you might think could be affected by it. A young person looking to join the military, or possibly parents advocating for a kid joining the military, conscientious citizens who care about the violence the U.S. wages in their name, advocates for women and people of color who understand the harsh environment the military creates for minorities and inflicts on those same minorities across the globe, and anyone else you think might be affected by it. Please take a moment, share this with them. Now, our podcast is supported in a few different ways. First, there's Patreon, where we're blessed to have an array of wonderful supporters helping the guys and I pay for some of the podcast's expenses. Those who contribute $10 a month or more will be mentioned right here as an honorary producer of the podcast, helping keep you, our listeners, stocked with new episodes. But you don't have to contribute $10 a month to help us. For as little as $1 a month, you can help keep us going, paying for hosting and storage fees, transcribing old and new episodes, promoting and expanding the podcast, and more I'm sure I can't think of at the moment. So let's bring out these honorary producers. And they are Will Arenz, Fahim Shirazi, Henry Zamota, Adam Bellows, Eric Phillips, Paul Appel, Julie Dupree, Thomas Benson, Emma P., Janet Hansen, Lawrence Taylor, and the Status Quo Podcast. Your contributions are wonderfully helpful to us. Thank you so much. However, if Patreon isn't your style, you can contribute directly to us through PayPal at paypal.me/Fortress on a Hill. Or please check out our store on Spreadshirt.com for some great Fortress merch. And do understand that if you can't afford to contribute to us, that doesn't bother us at all. This is a hard time for everybody, and we just want to make sure that what we share gets to as many people as possible. And now, let's get back to the podcast. Is there any hope that you see of infectious disease or disease outbreaks becoming an enemy that the military treats more dangerously than terrorism or major power conflicts? And Just like, and exactly like what you were saying, is that might that change be enough to help shift some of our massive spending towards a genuine and legitimately dangerous target?
Well, I mean, the short answer is no. I don't see any hope of that. I mean, the military industrial complex is, of course, devoted to continuing to have resources be funneled into their coffers, which are for war and preparation for war. Whereas, you know, this would require a major diversion of resources away from their own programs to somebody else's programs, because nobody's going to give the Pentagon or the Armed Services or the contractors, you know, the money to play with in order to do something about, you know, pandemics. So there's a direct contradiction there between the interests of those who've had their way in the United States for so many decades and today still, you know, dominate completely the capture of resources politically in this country, and the interests of those who care about the pandemics problem. It's going to have to come from somewhere else. And the question is, what interest groups are powerful enough to essentially compete for the kind of influence that is required to force that kind of change in spending priorities? I mean, it's not inconceivable that something like that could happen, but at this moment, at least, there's been no real movement in that direction. And you just ask yourself, where is it going to come from? What is the interest group that has the ability to shift public opinion in a massive way quickly through propaganda, through, you know, basically getting messages out in an urgent way that are heard by billions of people? And I think the question answers itself. I mean, there's nobody on the horizon that can do that in a way that gives you any confidence that it can happen. I mean, I hope I'm wrong, but, you know, that's my very pessimistic reading for the moment, at least. But I'd be interested in how you guys see that as well. I mean, what's your take on it?
I was very surprised in doing research on the coronavirus when the pandemic first started that the military didn't have any ships where their medical capabilities leaned at all towards infectious disease. The two Navy ships, the hospital ships we have, the Comfort, and I can't think of the name of the other one, they're both designed for your standard kind of trauma wounds, you know, combat mm-hmm. zone type mm-hmm. things.
Right. But
they're not designed at all for a pandemic. And the fact that following what happened with Ebola, that the Obama administration didn't attempt to do some kind of change in that is very exemplary of what we're all experiencing with this, because they were the ones that had the team. They were the ones that actually made some preparation before the Trump administration took it away. Why wasn't more done then?
Well, I would just point out that although the Obama administration did have those plans, you're absolutely right, they also let the ball drop in the last years or last couple of years of the Obama administration, when they had the strongest reason, the strongest motivation, if you will, to actually purchase the goods that were needed to refill the coffers for these emergency goods that would be needed in the event of a pandemic like this.
Right.
They didn't do it. And that's because they were captured by this this neoliberal notion that you rely on the market. You do it through the marketplace.
Yep.
And that was a huge turning point, and one that has drastic consequences, has had and will have drastic consequences, I'm sorry to say. So we are really up against it in terms of major underlying movements of power in this society that have taken place kind of under the radar, as it were, for most people, certainly, including myself. I admit it. I didn't see this until, you know, it was already a full-blown crisis, and then I had to catch up with the reality. I didn't know that this had happened. And now we have a much clearer picture that these things have changed so dramatically, so radically over a couple of 2 to 3 decades that we are in serious trouble, the most serious trouble that a society could be in regard to getting out of this situation. The path out is simply not clear at this moment, to my mind. And I'm glad to have Eddie chime in and suggest that there's something that I'm missing here.
I was reading one of your recent articles where you were talking about the privatization of the military, and specifically when it comes to drones. And that's something that's kind of near and dear to my heart, having been involved in like operations including drones. And I love in the article you pointed out, you know, the dramatic increase of contractors over the last, you know, 15 years. Mm-hmm. Everything you said just reminded me of like being at work. And, you know, I worked at an NSA building. And so there's, you know, multi-service environments, different contractors, everything like that. And most of the kids that I was in the Navy with, I would see them get out of uniform, and then like 2 weeks to a month later, they would be working in the building, like wearing business casual, because of course they are, because they're making twice to three times as much doing the exact same job. And if you like doing what you're doing, then of course you're going to move on to that, because that's a better option. But it was just so frustrating to me, because those people are not held to the same accountability standards as we are. And when it comes to even working within the like agency, when you're like assigned to an NSA shop, or they don't have the same guidelines that we have as like being a part of the military, or even being a part of the agency, like what the agency folks have to follow. So it, like in this age of the fact that we doing person-to-person operations are going to be so limited, I'm like, what is the next best thing? Of course, it's drones. And we've already seen a crazy big increase over the fact of the Trump administration. But it just, I mean, that's what scares me the most, is the fact that we're just going to continue to push, we're going to continue to push warfighting capability off of the military and to these private companies. And we're going to think in the neoliberal sense that, oh, this is better for us because blah, blah, blah. And it just frustrates me so much, because it's clearly not true. It's not working. And the fact that when they aren't held accountable to the same standards as us, to the same reporting requirements, to, you know, even just acknowledging the like effectiveness of their work, I think that is really damaging. And I think that might be one of those things that really gets people to start thinking about how we can change our perspective on this military industrial complex. Like when we have people who are doing the job of soldiers, but they're not actually soldiers or sailors.
Yeah.
You know, is that going to help shift maybe our mentality as far as like hero worship? I don't know.
Well, you're absolutely right that the, neoliberals have been able to basically get their way in regard to the whole question of the Pentagon's operations. It's the people who are working for contractors who've filled more and more of the positions there, and to the point where, you know, the Secretary of Defense didn't even know how many contractors were in his own office. It was an insidious process that had gone so far so fast that the people who were not part of the private contractor aspect of this didn't even really know what had hit them. It had moved that fast. And the outcome is that, again, you know, private interests are much more powerful than ever before. And, you know, the line between the private interest and public interest has now been muffled and you know, is no longer clear. And as a result, you know, I think we have a situation where you can't even say that the Pentagon represents anything but a coalition in which private interests are the dominant factor. And that's really going to be a central point in the book that I hope to write about this, which I intend to write about this starting right now. I think that it's not well understood, and it really does need to be understood by many more people, just how far the military-industrial complex has been taken over by and is defined by private interests, to the point where, you know, one person who was quoted some years back, you know, he was a retired general. He was quoted as saying that, you know, the if we knew just how much influence the private sector has gained over this, people would be very upset. And you know, he had only recently come to realize just how much the Pentagon was defined by private interests. And that, I think, is a major weakness politically that has to be exploited and brought out in a much more forceful way.
Absolutely. I think that the privatization aspect and the distancing of the United States from, or the American people in particular, from war in its operations, right? The new American way of war, which is really sort of a back to the future aspect, is really, you know, it's disturbing, but it's of a piece with the strategy to maintain endless war. Yeah. As you mentioned in the earlier sort of rejoinder about Vietnam as compared to the anti-war movement today, you know, it's kind of more invisible. And it seems, and I'd be interested in your thoughts on this. You know, obviously the most seemingly farcical, but I also think foreboding aspect of this, or recent aspect, has been, of course, this coup attempt by mercenaries in Venezuela. But I would argue, and I'd be interested in your thoughts, of course, that this is sort of, you know, indicative of a new age of proxy war, which could, right, you know, only grow as a pandemic proxy strategy. But, you know, are we seeing that the elites, Democrat and Republican, neoliberal and neoconservative, are pulling back from even the Iraq style occupation, which didn't garner the anti-war vehemence of Vietnam, but was costly and did cause a little bit of public turmoil? Or are they pulling away from that? And is drones and privatization a core aspect of that? And will we see more of it?
Yeah, I think that the Iraq experience, on top of the Vietnam experience, but obviously much more recent and much more relevant to the calculations of the present generation in the Pentagon and the armed services, I think that it's extremely important in understanding the way in which the people in the Pentagon think about the future of the military. And I think that it is indeed aimed at fighting wars in ways that reduce the human footprint relative to technology, and ensure against any future anti-war movement arising. I think there's no doubt that there's a connection between those earlier experiences and the new way of war that has been taking shape now for years.
So to drill down a bit then to a region or a case study that you've covered a lot, and I'll ask sort of some specific questions, but I would encourage you in the tone and theme of this conversation to, of course, where you see fit, build it into or thread it into this larger national security state. I'm interested in Iran, which obviously you've done a ton of work on, and in some cases you're probably tired of talking about, but it does seem that American military policy towards Iran, both planned and executed, because there's a gap, it seems, there, is of a, again, relevant to this larger conversation. So specifically, your recent work on the collusion between my buddy, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, who I admit I have a nemesis blind spot for, so take everything I say with a grain of salt, but between him and the somehow still Israeli Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu to, gin up a war, it seems, with Iran, that your work on it has been striking. Even though I'm probably more familiar with the broad strokes of this relationship and relevant history than most, it still shocks me. And I truly think it should be front page news, like on the daily, and of course it's not. So with that, I guess, what are the just brief realities of the Pompeo Bibi nexus that make it so troubling and so indicative or reflective, if that's the case, of the system we're discussing?
Right. I mean, Pompeo and Netanyahu are indeed the dangerous combination that lurks behind the issue of U.S. policy toward Iran. And the reason is that Pompeo, as Secretary of State, has been the figure that has moved the policy consistently over the past year and a half toward the crisis between the United States and Iran, if not outright war. I mean, he has, in fact, carried out a couple of maneuvers that have, in fact, carried a risk of war between the United States and Iran. I mean, fortunately, we have a president who is not very bright, but instinctively does not like the idea of going to war against Iran. He has no feeling that there's a necessary cause, a casus belli, if you will, between the United States and Iran. Trump does or does not, and therefore, in the two instances that have occurred, one, I have to stop and think now of the specific timing of this, but the first was in was last year, approximately. Let's see now. I think it was the summer, and there was a case where the United States had to make a decision, where the president had to make a decision about whether he was going to basically drop bombs on Iran over the shoot down of a U.S. Drone. And that was one where you had recommendation from his advisor to go ahead and go to war, and Trump almost did it, but then pulled back at the last minute to Pompeo's dissatisfaction. Then more recently, you had a case where in January you had the recommendation by Pompeo for essentially bombing an Iranian target, in Iraq, and basically the president went along with it, but the Iranians were able to have a situation without essentially triggering a war. So you have here a very dangerous combination of Pompeo, who is really doing his best to try to provoke an armed conflict between the United States and Iran, working closely with Bibi Netanyahu, and we know how close they have been colluding with one another over the past year and a half, more. And, you know, you have a situation where the president has thus far been able to avoid war, but it is, you know, he is subject to being manipulated. We know that he can be deceived on occasion if a clever enough setup is maneuvered, a setup, you know, that seems to involve a situation that most people in the United States might regard as a casus belli, then he's tempted to listen to what Pompeo is telling him. And that's the real danger that we're up against here. I do think, in fact, that Trump would like to avoid war, and I'm hopeful that that's going to be the case. But Pompeo is definitely somebody who is very clever, knows how to whisper in Trump's ear. I think he's very effective in that regard, and that's what makes him so dangerous. On the Iranian side, I have to say that, I have no doubt that the Iranians would like to avoid war with the United States. But if there is an attack on Iran per se, of course, they will respond, and there will be war between the United States and Iran. I have no doubt.
I think what you brought up is super interesting regarding, you know, it seems to me, and you have to be careful whenever you say this, because, of course, the reflexive response is that you love Trump or you love the Islamic Republic. I think that the record shows, and you've written about this, that Trump has shown restraint obviously assassinating the top general and political figure in Iran was tantamount to war.
Yeah.
So this was abhorrent and unforgivable because he is the decider, as Bush would have said, George W. Bush. But in many cases, Trump has shown a degree of restraint on the Iran issue, despite being pushed in a number of directions and even some what could be called provocations, although there's a lot of backstory to them. So you've got Trump showing some restraint. And then I think you've got Iran showing enormous restraint sort of time and again. You know, even the missile response at Balad and all this was, yeah, I mean, it's difficult to know exactly what they're aiming for, but the Iraqi government was kind of in on it. I mean, there was enough warning, and they've really shown. It seems to me that Trump doesn't really want war. Iran is doing all it can to avoid it, largely. And yet, we have Pompeo and Netanyahu who won't take no for an answer. And so, you know, thoughts on that, but also, what's the end game for a Pompeo or a Netanyahu? I mean, what are these folks really after? What's the end game? Yes, okay, war, but why and to what end?
Well, you know, we know for one thing that Netanyahu personally has for years been arguing both privately and publicly that Iran is not strong enough to be able to threaten or to consider seriously a retaliation that would bring about a counter-retaliation from the United States that could basically devastate its economy and its entire military capability. He's been arguing that consistently for years, and it seems that he does believe in that. At least there's a reasonable chance that that's the case. And I would hesitate to make the argument against that assumption. I think it's much more prudent to assume that he does believe, I think falsely, that he could get away with, in conjunction with the United States, with Pompeo, getting the United States to take a poke at Iran without suffering a serious risk of a wider war. And I think that's at the root of this situation that you've been describing, that it's Netanyahu's overconfidence that he can mess around with Iran and Pompeo's willingness to do whatever Bibi suggests, because apparently you know, he feels that alignment with the pro-Israeli faction in American politics is his ticket to a future presidential bid. I assume that that's the case. I think there's a lot of evidence to that effect. And so I think we have that situation that holds out serious risk of a miscalculation here. Now, the hopeful part of this situation, I would say, is that I'm not sure that Trump is willing to keep Pompeo on beyond his current term in office. I have a feeling that Pompeo may be gone, that he's not really very happy with Pompeo at all, to say the least, and that he would like to see him replaced. I don't think he wants to do it during a presidential year, but once that's finished, and assuming that he would be reelected for the moment, I think there's a very strong chance that he'll be replaced.
That's interesting. You know, I hadn't thought enough about a post-administration Pompeo, you know, what role he would play outside the administration, whether he would stick around. You know, I'm not a Pompeo expert, although I'm dabbling, and I know that you're not. I'm often left wondering if Pompeo is really, you know, eschatological, believes in the rapture, like he says in many of his earlier speeches at these evangelical churches about supporting Israel and the world ending there. Is he more, you know, rapture guy, or is he more like Machiavelli Mike? I'm on the fence about that, and we can discuss it. You know, but as we sort of wrap up or come full circle, I think you raised some things that tied in with an article I wrote and that I'd like to hear your comments on specific to this. So, okay, Pompeo is the top diplomat, even though the State Department has been utterly militarized for a long time, and especially under him. And he went to West Point and graduated in 1986, and Mark Esper is in charge of war, right? The defense, as we call it. And he went to West Point, class of 1986. And I found out through some research that so did a few dozen folks who were deep in the military-industrial complex. But what strikes me more than just the details of what I uncovered, which I won't recount, is as we use the Iran case study, and as we look at who these folks are at the top and infused throughout the system. You know, I think some of the things you've brought up that I'd be interested in your thoughts on are coming to fruition here, where we have this really disturbing and nefarious situation where, you know, Mark Esper, the classmate of Mike Pompeo, who was a lobbyist for Raytheon, which of course makes the Patriot missile system, as well as a few of their classmates who are lower ranking, who left, in one case, the air defense artillery community and moved over to Raytheon. Another guy who also left the air defense artillery community, which isn't responsible for the Patriot system, and then went to work for Lockheed on the THAAD system, right? The theater air defense system, similar sort of thing. And so what you have, it seems, in back to that self-licking ice cream cone, but in a dangerous way, is you have Pompeo ginning up the war that Esper will execute and probably in the end support, all of which is to the profound, you know, pecuniary benefit of Esper's former employer, several of their classmates who work for Lockheed and Raytheon. And what's the output? Well, even if there's no war, the output already has been the THAAD and the Patriot flowing into the Gulf to the Emiratis and the Saudis in these massive contracts, and then physically actually being transferred over the course of the last year. So, you know, what do you make of this? And we've covered it, but this to me, with the Iran scenario and these figures, these human figures making history turn, something's going on there that is just worthy of, well, of this whole conversation.
Well, it is an important question that you're raising. And by the way, I did have a chance to read your piece. I loved it. I took copious notes from it. I found a lot of interesting stuff that I intend to consider carefully in my own writing, for sure, because this is very good data about the entire complex and how it operates, and the increasing, you know, revolution of the revolving door syndrome, if you will. But what I do think is worth considering here is that that obviously these people, although they're all class of 86 and they all belong to a system which is headed in the same broad direction, nevertheless, each individual, of course, is after his own interests. And you know, the interests of Lockheed and Raytheon and so on and so forth are one set of interests. And Pompeo is on another trajectory, which, you know, is obviously indirectly related to that. But his trajectory involves obviously making a whole new set of connections that are not directly related to the contractor interests per se, but rather to major political interests that have political constituencies, broad political constituencies, including, you know, very specifically the pro-Israeli community in the United States. That's one that he has, you know, he hopes to have a lock on as a basis for future presidential politics, and, you know, for good reason. And I think you're right to question, you know, how serious his commitment is to, you know, the rapture and all that sort of thing. I think it, I mean, he's a political calculator, and this is undoubtedly primarily, if not exclusively, political rather than religious. But having said that, I mean, you know, I think the key thing is that he's on a trajectory that involves preparing for a bid for a presidential election effort, whereas the other members of the class of 86 at West Point are hoping to get jobs in the private sector or in the Pentagon or going back and forth between the two. So, you know, I think you've got two sides of that complex represented. And you know, I think Pompeo being the much more powerful one at this point is attuned to a broader set of interests that are not necessarily, obviously, not in conflict with, but are more allied with the religious community rather than with the business community in terms of the ones that the class of 86 has primarily been involved with. So I would just differentiate between those two sets of interests.
Absolutely. I think that one of the things that's important in the work that you're doing and that on some level I'm doing in all my discussions of the MIC, which seems, you know, it inevitably comes up in anything I write about, is that, you know, we have to be careful, and I know that your work will, to be clear about what we're saying and to not fall into this idea that there is a vast centrally led conspiracy. Would that it were, almost, right? It seems almost as though it would be easier to fight if there was, you know, a single head or a single series of colluding figures, a cabal in a smoke-filled room that was making all this happen, when, like, I sort of try to make clear in the piece, because I was getting ready for the attacks, is, look, this truly is systemic, as much as that word is overused, and has built ad hoc over a long period of time, and involves a lot of overlapping interests that in many cases, you know, complement one another and create layers that are difficult to get through. And so while there is a system, there is such a structure as the military-industrial complex, it happened, if not accidentally, it happened in sequence and in phases, and involves human beings, right? Actors who are part of the human condition, motivated by their own sort of things. But, you know, I think what you're describing is so important, because we, meaning folks who raise the alarm about this, are too easily dismissed if we come off as saying that this is simple and it's just a conspiracy, and, you know, yell like Alex Jones about it or something, you know, when in reality...
I couldn't agree more. It's very important to understand this as a market phenomenon, essentially. I mean, it's neoliberalism as applied to, you know, the to the military industrial sector. And that means that it does operate as a market and is not centrally controlled. It's you're right. It's even more dangerous precisely because of that. It's more dangerous in the sense that it's more effective and harder to cope with in political terms.
Absolutely.
That's what bothers me about neoliberalism, is that it always tries to make us think that people are selfish and greedy and they just want whatever they want, right? So in order to for people to get any kind of thing that they want, they have to act in that same way. And it's patently false. Like, everything we know about social science and psychology, neuroscience, we know that people are inherently social creatures and they are inherently generous. Like, yes, people exhibit selfish traits at times, but most of the time we work cooperatively because that's how humans got to where we are, right? And it just, it's been so frustrating to see neoliberalism like wheedle its way into everything. And now we have this idea where we feel like, oh, what do we do about it? And we always initially start with the individual, like, what can I do? And like, I like that to an extent. I like the idea of, like, yes, we need to be responsible for ourselves and we need to, like, take initiative. But we as individual people can only do so much. And when you're trying to go up against these big systems, we can't do that by ourselves. We have to do it as a group, as a movement, as an organized thing. And it gets, like, it's nice that we continue to poke these out, to point these out and to show, like, hey, look at what's happening here. But it's like, I'm hoping that this virus will really push us. I mean, the people who are stuck in the right-wing media vacuum, it's hard to reach them. But I feel like everybody else, you know, we can push them and we can be like, no, the only way we can move forward past this is by doing it together instead of hunkering down and trying all this austerity crap, like trying spending some money in like on people. What a surprise.
Well, absolutely. This coronavirus crisis is the ultimate test, if you will, of, you know, the possibility of moving beyond a sort of selfish model for how things should work and do work. And, you know, I think we are all really riveted to this drama to see how this does in fact play out, because it's all important that that this does lead to a cooperative mentality, a cooperative spirit in American society and politics. That's the only way out.
Absolutely. If there's a gift of Corona, for lack of a better term, it does seem to be a degree of exposure of the system that's been in place, that's been operating as designed and failing according to its operations as designed, which applies to, of course, our primary focus, foreign policy, but the always related, always connected, never easily dismissed or bifurcated domestic component. And what I've really enjoyed about our conversation is the degree to which we've transcended those sort of boundaries and even been a little interdisciplinary, right, to throw out the academic terminology. So this has been great. We've kept you now for a half hour longer than I promised, which is typical if you've ever listened to our podcast. So with that, Gareth, is there something we're missing, or is there somewhere you'd like to end, or was there somewhere you'd like to direct our listeners for your work and things to sort of check out and be paying attention to?
Well, I'm happy to let your listeners know that I have a new home, if you will, in terms of publishing regularly. I'm now going to be contributing on a regular basis to The Gray Zone, which is a up-and-coming, rapidly rising site that deals with national security policy, foreign policy issues, and has a very strong investigative orientation. And so it's very much the kind of site that is perfect for what I want to write about. And I'm very happy to have this relationship with The Gray Zone and Max Blumenthal, who's the one who's started it and is the moving spirit behind it.
Absolutely. I'm a big fan of Max, of the site. When you've been there a little longer, perhaps you can shuffle one of my better articles in Max's direction. it's a great site, and everyone who hasn't already started reading it needs to check it out, as well as so your columns there, some of the other writers, and then your books past and present, and then future, because I think that the project you're working on has such potential and couldn't be more timely. So Gareth, I want to thank you again for the generosity with your time and your ideas, and having what I think was one of our really cooler and more comprehensive conversations about maybe the most important topic in national security today.
Well, it's a very great privilege for me to be on your show. I thanks so much to both of you for having me on. I appreciate it and look forward to doing it again sometime.
Absolutely, we will do it again, and at the very least, when that book is coming to fruition, we're gonna say we talked about it first, and we're gonna have you back on for that, if not sooner. So thanks again, Gareth, and we'll talk soon.
Thank you.
Great.
Thank you.
All right, please correct my complete sort of lapse there in the middle.
No worries. Henry is our Henry actually jumped off a few minutes back for an appointment, so I front loaded his series of questions. But he's our tech guy. He's the real brains behind the operation. So he's pretty good at editing, and we'll get it out of there, no problem.
Great.
And yeah.
Good to have the chance to chat.
Absolutely.
Thank you so much.
And keep doing what you're doing, and stay in touch, Gareth, and
yep,
for anything, and we'll be in touch.
All right, good luck.
All right, great. You have a good one.
We're on Twitter at Fortress on a Hill, and also at Facebook.com at Fortress on a Hill. You can find our main blog page and our full collection of episodes at www.fortressonahill.com. iTunes, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, Patreon, Spotify, you name it, almost anywhere you listen, we're already waiting for you. And hey, we're always in the market for more Patreon supporters. Please consider becoming a patron at patreon.com. And if you're not into giving us a monthly payment, think about giving us a couple bucks on PayPal. The link is in the show notes. Skepticism is one's best armor. Never forget it. We'll see you next time.
And listen to my song. I hope you'll pay attention. I will not.